You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Screens of the Stone Age, the podcast where scientists review movies about prehistoric people. I'm Dr. Joshua Lindell. I am a paleoanthropologist studying Neanderthals, and I'm here with...
I'm Dr. Kimberly Plomp. I am a bioarchaeologist. I study the human skeleton, health and disease, and evolution.
And I'm Dr. Ross Barnett, paleogeneticist interested in Ice Age mammals, particularly cats.
And I'm Joe Wood. I am a museum educator and paleontologist.
Thanks for joining us today, Joe. You are joining us because we are watching the movie Jurassic Park 2, and none of us are dinosaur paleontologists, so you're going to help us out with this one. I think this... brings to a close the original Jurassic Park trilogy. This will be the third of the three original Jurassic Park movies that we've covered. I think that's the first time we've completed a trilogy, huh?
Yep. Mm.
I'm really excited that I got this one. Because if you can't have the first one, which is a timeless classic, and Dr. Kinkella had covered Jurassic Park 3, which I do have a lot of love for because of many things in it, including the Spinosaurus. This is the one, I think, that was kind of the last time that they really cared about, like, doing dinosaur science and depicting it on film. Maybe that's not fair, but certainly by the time we got to the Jurassic World ones, I think they had kind of thrown that out the window.
Yes, for sure.
I should mention that I'm not a dinosaur paleontologist by training. That's sort of my area of expertise now and what I end up talking about most of the time, because I work in a science museum and that's what people want to talk about. But my training in graduate school was actually fossil mammals.
Okay. Cool. I was just in photogrammetering a stegodon molars last week.
That's awesome. We were looking at survivorship across the KPG boundary. So who survived the mass extinction that wiped out the non-bird dinosaurs? So I remember in the field when we would find fragments of dinosaur bone, like tons of like Edmontosaurus, which is the like the cow of the Cretaceous. We were at in the Hell Creek. Actually, we were just above the Hell Creek. Our advisor would yell at us like, quit playing with dinosaur bones, because we were looking... one layer up to find teeth. My advisor is a tooth expert. So we used to have, we had a microscope in our lab that was very good for photographing and measuring teeth. And so the folks from the anthropology department would often be in our lab to photograph their teeth. So I've met a lot of anthropologists and archaeologists over the years.
Very cool.
And I'm very happy to be here.
Well, Joe, could I ask you to summarize this movie for any of our listeners who haven't seen it?
Yes, I would love to do that. So I think maybe we hadn't started recording yet, but Kim, you pointed out that this is one of the two of these movies that's based off of a book. So this is based off of The Lost World, Jurassic Park. I think the book is just called The Lost World.
Yeah.
Yeah. And apparently Steven Spielberg was... concerned that people would not know that this was that they should go see this movie if it was simply called The Lost World, even though he was very enamored with the idea of making a movie as an homage to the Lost World, the novel, as well as the 1960 film. But anyway, this is based off of the Michael Crichton book, which apparently he was convinced to write after Jurassic Park made dump trucks full of money.
That'll do you.
And he sort of wrote the book somewhat concurrently with Spielberg and the screenwriter David Koepp writing the film. So anyway, so this movie takes place supposed to be about 4 years after the events of the first movie, and it came out 4 years later, so that sort of makes sense. It starts off with this wealthy British family. They are on a yacht on it's actually Hawaii, but it's meant to be Costa Rica. And you come to find out that they are on an island that is near Isla Nublar, the island from the original movie. The little girl is running off, and her sort of nervous mother is calling after her. Her kind of like, the father's like sitting there reading a magazine or a newspaper and is saying like, you know, let her go play. And she runs off and she sees what we later come to find out is a Compsognathus. And I do have notes about all of the species featured in this movie, which we could talk about as much as you like. But the Compsognathus, or the Compies, they are these small bird-like dinosaurs. And initially she asks, you know, is it some kind of strange bird? But the encounter turns dangerous when a bunch of them show up and attack her. Now, I saw this movie as a kid, and I was like, oh my God, did the little girl die?
Well, yeah, me too.
But of course, it is revealed later, like off screen, that apparently she was fine. Which is interesting because we see later on that these animals can be very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so this sets off a chain of events. InGen, the company owned by John Hammond, played by Sir Richard Attenborough, who created Jurassic Park in the first film, they're being sued. And there's a deleted scene that shows the board meeting where John Hammond's nephew, Peter Ludlow, who was played by Arliss Howard, apparently I had to have a dialect coach for this for some reason. they're having a board meeting and they're talking about how they're getting sued and they have to figure out how to recoup their costs. And they're voting to oust Hammond from the company. But we see in the theatrical release, one of the heroes from the original film, Dr. Ian Malcolm, mathematician, played by one of our best actors.
best people,
Jeff Goldblum. And he is going to meet Mr. Hammond, who is asking him to go to the island. I'm sorry, to go to Site B, which is revealed that they bred the dinosaurs on a different island and shipped the quote-unquote finished product over to Isla Nublar, what we saw in the original film. Initially, he is Jeff Goldblum. Dr. Malcolm is skeptical because he remembers almost being eaten by the dinosaurs. There's the iconic line where Mr. Hammond says, "I'm not making the same mistakes again." And Malcolm says, no, you're making all new ones.
Such a good line.
It is.
Mr. Hammond has been convinced of the error of his ways, and he would like to protect the animals on this island, which have formed a functioning ecosystem. Eventually, Malcolm is convinced to go because it's revealed that his girlfriend, Dr. Sarah Harding, played by Julianne Moore, is already on the island. So he goes along with like a equipment specialist named Eddie Carr and a video documentarian who was revealed to be like an activist, played by Vince Vaughn, named Nick Owen. So they get to the island. There's just an amazing scene where they meet Dr. Harding photographing Stegosaurus, a herd of them. And she, for an animal behaviorist, she's getting very close to the baby Stegosaurus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she told him you can't smoke because it's going to disturb the environment too much. But then she goes up and pets the Stegosaurus.
She immediately talks about taking no, like leaving no trace, and then immediately is petting the baby dinosaur. But we'll leave that aside. There's an exciting scene where the Stegosaurus parents get upset, but then they go away. And then pretty shortly after that, she meets the rest of the team. It's revealed that Ian Malcolm's daughter has stowed away and is now part of the expedition. But before they can sort of come to a conclusion about what to do with her, the InGen crew comes and they're flying in all these helicopters. They have all this heavy equipment. And there's this amazing scene that they call the Dinosaur Roundup, where they are capturing all these dinosaurs. It's revealed that they are going to take the dinosaurs back to the mainland to be part of a Jurassic Park theme park. And they are led by the nephew of John Hammond, Peter Ludlow, as well as Roland Tembo, played by Peter Postlethwaite, who is chewing every ounce of scenery and every shot that he's in a way
Definitely.
That I love. He's portraying like the great white hunter. So they round up all the dinosaurs, but then our heroes, led by Nick Owen, who Vince Vaughn, who is apparently like done some sabotaging of corporations in the past, they release a bunch of the dinosaurs. This causes a ruckus, so to speak, in the InGen camp. But it's also revealed at this point that the hunters had captured an infant T-Rex and it's hurt its leg. So Dr. Harding takes the injured, or I'm sorry, Owen and Dr. Harding take the T-Rex back into their big van trailer contraption that they brought to the island. Of course, the parents show up while they're trying to heal the baby T-Rex. There's this iconic scene where the T-Rexes are attacking their trailer. And eventually their trailer is destroyed. One of their number, the engineer Eddie Carr, is killed, and they have to sort of throw in with the hunters in order to escape the island by getting to a abandoned InGen facility that has a radio. So they go through, they're attacked by the T-Rex again, eats some of the InGen people. Another InGen hunter is killed by some Compsognathus in another one of the sort of like iconic scenes that was apparently like very difficult to animate at the time. Then they get to the InGen facility. They are attacked by velociraptors in tall grass. They are able to contact the mainland to send help. But before they do this, the hunter, Roland Tembo, tranquilizes the T-Rex and subdues it so that they don't leave empty-handed. They are taking it back to the mainland. He wanted to hunt the T-Rex, but Vince Vaughn's character had removed the shells from his hunting rifle. So now they're going to the mainland. Dr. Harding and Ian Malcolm rush to try to convince the InGen people that this is a terrible idea to have the T-Rex in their theme park. Before they can do that, the ship carrying the T-Rex, I'm not sure how the T-Rex ate everyone on the ship when it was in the cargo hold.
Yeah, we can get into that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Who knows? But the ship crashes onto the island, and there's the third act features the T-Rex rampaging through San Diego in sort of a Godzilla slash King Kong homage. Eventually, they're able to lure the T-Rex back to the ship with the baby again, tranquilize it, and send it back. Not before our bad guy, the evil nephew, is eaten by the baby T-Rex as its first kill. And then it's revealed sort of like in like on a television screen that the Navy is escorting the ship back and that the island will now be a protected sanctuary, sort of completing Hammond's vision.
And see.
Yeah.
Ross, I strove for a level of detail in that
yeah, it was good.
Retelling fitting yours.
That was good. That was all the major kind of beats of the film. And yeah, I was surprised by how fairly decent it was. Having not seen it before.
Oh,
you haven't seen this before?
No, I've never seen it before.
Oh, wow.
I saw this in the theater.
Yeah, same.
I saw the original in the theater.
I did too. I was about 8 years old and I probably should not have been viewing that film, but no one knew what Jurassic Park was.
My family knew, but they just knew that I had to go.
It was your thing. Yeah.
I guess that's true. My mom was an avid reader and she read all the books. So I guess she knew that there was like going to be people being eaten by dinosaurs, but she had this child who was like obsessed with dinosaurs. So
yeah,
how are you not going to take him to the dinosaur movie?
Yeah.
I don't remember if I saw this one in the theater, but I definitely read the book before I saw the movie. And so I would have been 12 when this movie came out, which means I would have read this book when I was 12 or younger, and I read Jurassic Park before this book. So I read the Jurassic Park book when I was 12 or younger. I think the book is a lot more graphic than the movie, at least for the first book. So
yeah, the book came out in 1995.
Right.
I don't know if I would have read it that early.
I read the first Jurassic Park after the first movie, but the second one before the second movie. And what really got me as a young girl, is that in the book, Sarah saves Malcolm when the trailers go over the edge. She grabbed him on her back and climbs up with him on her back. And wow. I loved that scene in the book when I was a young girl. And then in the movie, he saved her. And it pissed me off.
I can imagine that being really frustrating. I do think that that character is... I did really like the Sarah Harding character. I think... you know, Julianne Moore is obviously like, you know, a very well-regarded actor, but also I liked that there was another paleontologist that was the hero in this film. I think that's kind of Sam Neill's character is in the next one. And there's also the the young strapping graduate student, as you refer to him as, Dr. Barnett. But yeah, I still think this is kind of the last one where they were really trying to show like what scientists do.
Yeah.
Apart from hanging out of like trucks over cliff edges and climbing ropes and
you guys don't do that?
Wrestling raptors.
Is that not part of your field work?
Well, it's been a while since I've had to climb a rope, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, and as archaeologists, we're more chased by mummies and stuff, so.
do people ask you if you're a paleontologist? Because certainly, as a paleontologist, I get asked if I'm an archaeologist.
No, I get asked if we study Loch Ness Monster. You get asked a lot about the aliens and the pyramids.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Well,
Imagine being a paleontologist called Ross, who comes from beside Loch Ness. How do those conversations go?
I feel for you, my friend. I do get the Ross Geller thing quite a lot, and I've never really watched Friends, so I understand that like they're trying to be nice because they're relating something that they know about to to you, but I really don't know. I never know how to respond. Like, oh, because I think he's kind of an annoying character, right? That's like his whole thing.
Yeah.
So I usually am like, oh, thanks.
It is a tough one.
Well, I think you usually go through like the inaccuracies of this movie, right?
Yeah, let's start with that. How pedantic can we get about the inaccuracies in this movie?
So I guess I want to say at the start that they did a pretty good job with the dinosaur stuff, especially for the time. There are some like silly things in this that we can, you know, talk about, but yeah, I have like kind of like the main ones bolded, and then there's like some more like pedantic ones. Like in my notes, I have the Pteranodon. They look pretty bad. Question mark. So I have like all levels of detail of pedantry here.
Maybe. Would it be fun to go through a list of all the dinosaurs that they have in this movie and talk about how accurate the depictions of the dinosaurs are or how accurate they would have been at the time?
Yeah, I think that would be awesome. I do have my notes sort of listed by dinosaurs. So so I think the first ones that you see are the Compsognathus. And so these are, that is a real dinosaur, and that was a Jurassic dinosaur. So
one of the few Jurassic dinosaurs in these Jurassic movies.
But these movies love to, I kind of don't blame them for this, but these movies love to make animals that were bigger, smaller, and animals that weren't that big, make them bigger. So this is one of the animals that they made smaller. But again, I kind of don't blame them. So if you will you look at skeletal diagrams or size comparisons of this animal, you will see that it's like about the size that you see in the movie, but that was based on the holotype. A holotype is like, for the audience, maybe don't know, that's the a specimen that was used to describe the species, and it's like the example that we compare it to. That was a German specimen found in the 1800s, and it's a juvenile, but there is another specimen from France that we think is an adult. And it is about a meter long. For my fellow Americans, that's about 3 feet. So a little bit bigger than what you see here.
What's that in freedom miles? It's about half a hogshead, I think, if my calculations are correct.
12 bananas or something.
So are you saying that there are only possibly two good specimens of this dinosaur then? Is that what it sounds like you're saying? Because do we not have like a larger sample? I mean, this is one of the things in human evolution is some of our species are named after like one specimen or something, right?
Yeah. So
not even a complete one. Yeah.
So you have with dinosaurs kind of every degree of completeness of the animal. So we do a lot of like science communication videos for my job, and we will get comments on YouTube to the effect of dinosaurs aren't real, or we've never found a complete dinosaur specimen. It's like, I can walk over here and show you one. We have complete specimens of the whole animal, And then there are taxa that, frankly, are described from like a single bone. We have everything in between. For Compsognathus, there is a complete specimen. That's the German one. That's the holotype. And then there's a pretty complete specimen that's from France. And then I think the rest are much more fragmentary.
Hmm.
So it, being a kind of a small animal, they tend to not fossilize as well.
All right.
Is there any fossil evidence for them kind of group living, or is that just an assumption based on sort of small size?
That is completely an invention for this movie. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of the things I didn't really talk about in my, I didn't write a lot of notes about was group behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some evidence for group behavior in dinosaurs, but the thing is, so first off, when we talk about dinosaurs, we're talking about everything from technically, Dinosauria is described as everything from Triceratops horridus to, I think, the house sparrow and everything in between, including their common ancestor. So from a phylogenetic sense. So there's such
great.
And we're spanning from 240 million years ago to today, if you include birds. Huge variety within that. So certainly some probably exhibited complex group dynamics and some were solitary. The problem is even when we have sort of evidence like footprints in the same location or even like what we would call a death assemblage where there's a bunch of them buried at the same time, we don't know whether they were buried that way, whether they lived together all the time, or if you think about the paleontologist, Dr. Dave Hone is does a lot with animal behavior, and he is fond of describing Cape buffalo crossing rivers. If there were to be a flood and bury a bunch of them, you'd get a death assemblage. But those animals don't act like that most of the year.
Mm-hmm.
They're off by themselves or in small groups. So I think, especially in like popular media, we over extrapolate from the fossil evidence. But I don't know. I think, you know, certainly some of them were in herds, but we don't have evidence for that for Compsognathus, certainly.
Okay.
One thing about this is that the character, the paleontologist, the bearded guy, Dr. Burke, who is meant to be an homage to Robert Bakker, who was never credited as an advisor for the Jurassic Park films, but did like some informal advising for these films and was like probably the most famous paleontologist at the time. He gets eaten.
And if you have any kind of sort of slight knowledge of dinosaurs in the 90s, it's clearly Bob Bakker that they're trying to make him, the cowboy hat, the long hair, the beard. I mean, they've only not called him that name, I think, because the lawyer said no. He's like they've just sort of slightly off-branded him so that they don't have to pay him any money. That's what it looks like.
Yeah,
he's definitely Temu.com Bob Bakker for sure.
And the character's name is Robert Burke, so they barely even changed the name. But I read that like Jack Horner was famously a consultant on these movies, and Robert Bakker was sort of a rival of Jack Horner. So I read that Jack Horner requested this scene to be put into the movie so that Jack Horner could have his rival Robert Bakker eaten by Tyrannosaurus.
They definitely had some different ideas about some of these things. Dr. Horner is sort of known for being kind of an iconoclast. He would often put forth controversial ideas about dinosaurs that would generate a lot of discussion. I'm being like extremely diplomatic in the way that I phrase that. Before I forget, the Burke character calls this animal Compsognathus triassicus, which is not a real animal. There is Compsognathus longipes, and there is also another animal called Procompsognathus triassicus. And I think there is a little bit of confusion because I might be wrong, but I think maybe in the book they're referred to as Procompsognathus, but that's another like small dinosaur. But that's one of those things where like you often point out on your show, they tried to say the science-y words and they messed it up. And if they had just called it compies or something, it would have been fine.
Yeah, they just went too far.
That's one thing I like about this movie, because like you said, to a certain extent, they do it in Jurassic Park 3, too, where they're still trying to get some science in. But like the first one is a real celebration of science.
Yes.
And this one, they have these characters. They have Robert Burke and they have Sarah Harding, where they do these like little snippets of exposition where they just like spew these little dinosaur facts at you throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Which I don't know how much it serves a movie in general, but I really like having these characters throw out these little dinosaur facts as we go through the movie that are mostly correct most of the time.
It gives us something to talk about. The last thing about Compsognathus, and most of these dinosaurs I don't have nearly as many notes, but Compsognathus, that German specimen that I talked about, this was studied by Darwin's colleague Huxley, and it was found shortly after Archaeopteryx. So he went to Germany to study it, comparing it to Archaeopteryx, and this was one of the things that gave him the idea that birds are dinosaurs. So the idea that birds are dinosaurs is not a new thing, even though it's still, I think, like just finally has trickled into the public consciousness. By the time you get to Jurassic Park in 1993, they're still posing it as sort of a debate, even though that was not really the case even at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, all the way to the 1860s, many people were recognizing this link, and Compsognathus was part of that.
I really want a movie featuring Thomas Henry Huxley, because I've never seen him in a movie, and I really want Tommy Lee Jones to play him, because you ever looked at photos of them side by side?
No.
He looks like Tommy Lee Jones with mutton chops.
Do we think Tommy Lee Jones could do the accent? Yeah.
I don't know, but it would be worth it.
I honestly, if he just did not try to do an accent at all.
Yeah.
Or I should say a different accent.
It would have to be an action adventure, because like Huxley is Darwin's bulldog, so he gets right in there. Yeah. But he does appear in a film. I think he appears in the film Creation, which is about like Darwin. It's got Jennifer Connelly and her real-life husband, whose name I forget.
Hmm.
He's a British actor.
Yeah, I guess Huxley should watch that.
Appears in that. Have we not watched that? That might be worth watching.
Oh, no, we haven't watched this. If this isn't on our list, we got to watch this.
The other movie that I really think they should make is the Bone Wars movie. And there's a posthumous novel from Crichton called Dragon's Teeth. That's an extreme dramatization of that I think would make a good movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if you just follow the real story, it would be
the
pretty.
The real story.
Doesn't need all that much so kind good. Of fluffing.
No, it doesn't.
For anybody who doesn't know it, if you read the book, The Gilded Dinosaur, covers it pretty well.
Yeah. Huxley, he's a great character. He's very much like a parallel of Darwin, except imagine if Darwin was like a kind of muscular, kind of go-getting, takes no shit from anyone kind of character, instead of the meek, wannabe priest that he ends up actually being. So Huxley kind of goes on a world tour on a ship, discovers lots of stuff, and then kind of gets back, hangs out in all the right circles, and kind of falls in love with the idea of natural selection and evolution, and then decides that he's not going to take any nonsense from anyone, and so goes to all the debates and argues really forcefully, and then gets the great nickname of Darwin's bulldog, which works perfectly.
He's every bit the like nemesis of creationists that they want Darwin to be, where he was like not at all a bad guy.
No.
he waited like decades to publish Origin because he knew that it was going to make people upset.
And actually seemed to like read it one day and then just gone out hunting for creationists like the very next morning. He's the one that's in the famous Wilberforce debate. That's Huxley that says he'd rather have an ape for a grandfather than somebody who lies and obfuscates and tries to confuse people with fancy words, which, you know, we're still talking about 150 years later.
Sure are. A great book about that that I recently read is called Dinosaurs at the Dinner Table. Well, actually, that's basically the end of the book, is the Huxley-Wilberforce debate. But it's really talking about people first finding, well, I should say Europeans, because people have been finding these bones in the ground for millennia. But Europeans finding these fossils and just saying, what the fuck? And trying to fit it into their worldview. That's honestly how all good science starts.
That's how all good science starts. It's just some people with a bit of background going, what the... And then trying to figure stuff out. That is science.
Sorry if you have to edit out my curses. Well, this is a family friendly podcast.
I curse all the time.
Yeah, I think I do have some sympathy for people who are like confused or have trouble wrapping their head around the idea of extinct animals like dinosaurs, because they're kind of speedrunning what people were doing, including scientists 200 years ago. Like, what are these things? How is it that there's a world that was different from the one that we live in today with a completely different cast of characters, of creatures? And now then you have to have that thought and then say, I wonder if anyone has also thought about this, and go to like read some books or ask someone who knows what they're talking about. But I do have some sympathy for that initial reaction.
Yeah.
All right. More dinosaurs?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. One question I had about those Compsognathus and just in dinosaurs in general is this movie doesn't have any feathered dinosaurs. By this point in the 90s, we knew dinosaurs should have feathers, but I don't personally know the extent to which dinosaurs should. So I kind of assume that all the theropods should have some amount of feathers, and should Compsognathus have some amount of feathers?
Probably. They would probably have had, at the very least, what we would call filamentous integument, or like a stage one feather. So if you imagine like a bird feather, that central shaft of the feather without the rest of the stuff on the side and sort of look kind of like hair-like, that's probably
like a coarse hair.
Yeah, that's what the initial feather structures would have looked like. And they were there for heat retention, because these were warm-blooded animals. And I do think this movie and the first one does a very good job of showing these as like very active animals. Now, as far as how widely distributed feathers are, this is still an area of debate. And I want to try not to just give my opinion, but summarize the discussion. So it's by the time this movie came out, 1 year prior, 1996, is when Sinosauropteryx was described from Liaoning in China. So prior to this, 1861, we have Archaeopteryx. And then not any more feathered dinosaur fossils until 1996. And I do think that this partly contributed to the birds as dinosaurs hypothesis falling by the wayside. But by 1996, we have this treasure trove of fossils from Liaoning. It's the Yushan formation, and actually we realized later that it's multiple fossil formations laying on top of each other. You'll often see it referred to as early Cretaceous, but there's actually an early Cretaceous formation and there's a late Jurassic formation that's under it, but I digress. And all these feathered dinosaur fossils start coming up, but they're all theropods, Josh, like you said. So this sort of confirms that all of the theropods, the two-legged, mostly meat-eating dinosaurs, one of the three major branches of dinosaurs, would have all had feathers. But the problem is then we started to find other dinosaurs. Also from Liaoning, you have Tianyulong, which is a heterodonterosaur. So it's an ornithischian. It's on the other big branch of dinosaurs. And then you get another animal called Calindodromius from Russia that's got multiple different feathery structures all over its body. And just a couple of years ago, we have a few papers of putative feathers in pterosaurs, which are the sister taxa to dinosaurs.
Mm.
But there's a couple of problems with this. So this has led a lot of people, myself included, I have to be honest, to subscribe to something called the avametatarsalian hypothesis. So avametatarsalia is the group that includes all dinosaurs and pterosaurs, and also some other relatives. This is the idea that they all had feathers. And by feathers, again, I mean those like hair-like structures. And then in the dinosaur groups that we don't find evidence for feathers, they either secondarily lost them or they have simply not preserved. The problem is, though, there are some people that subscribe to the tetanuran hypothesis, which is just theropods only. And all those other animals that I mentioned, those are not feathers. They are structures that evolved independently, possibly from the same genetic architecture in the skin. And there's many positions in between. So the problem is all the feathered dinosaurs we have are from the Cretaceous. So they're from a long time after feathers would have evolved. So this causes a problem.
Mm-hmm.
We would really like to find feathered animals in the Triassic? And that would really answer this question. But the Triassic fossil record is not great.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And what's even worse is the Middle Jurassic. This is a huge problem in paleontology. The Middle Jurassic is when, like, the first birds must have evolved, or like the immediate, like, antecedents to, like, Archaeopteryx. And we have almost no rocks of that age worldwide. They've all been scraped away, or were not deposited, or have been, you know, subducted under the crust. We're never going to find them.
Oh, no.
It sucks. But we continue to search. So I can't answer that question.
Yeah, it just needs a couple of lucky strikes, and then you could have a new understanding. Yeah.
All it would take is one. It could just take one big find from, yeah, like the Triassic of South America or Africa to really, like, help answer this question. But you'd need to have a special type of preservation, what we call a Konservat Lagerstätten, which would be where you get these feather impressions. Normally, you just get bones, teeth, things like that. So, yeah, we'll keep looking.
Yeah.
So I think the compi should have had feathers. I actually think all of these things, if you like zoomed in, should have had some fuzz. That's what I think. And a lot of people think that as well. But it's not a monolithic opinion.
I guess there's also, you know, the issue that we have in sort of, even in mammal reconstructions, with sort of similarly with hair, like above a certain sort of size threshold, then you have the opposite problem that you're not wanting to conserve heat, you're wanting to dissipate it. And so that's why, like, the biggest mammals, things like elephants, rhinos, aren't very hairy, although they do still have hair. It's there. It's just not forming the same kind of function as in smaller mammals.
Yes.
And I guess that could feed into some of the larger dinosaurs, like in this film in particular, like when you see the T-Rex or the Stegosaurus not having any integument, then that could be because they're just too big and they don't need it, and they just want to kind of get rid of all the heat they're generating from their warm-blooded muscle mass.
Yeah, the long neck sauropod that you see briefly in this film is a Mamenchisaurus or a Mamenchisaurus, which is notable for having, like, this insanely long neck, like even longer than most other sauropods. And those animals, we've never found any sauropods or their early ancestors with filamentous integument.
Well,
so did they lose it? Did they never have it? Are we just not finding the fossils? These are all options.
I've definitely seen some, like, artistic reconstructions of sauropods with some, like, spiny, feathery things coming out the back of their head or maybe the tip of their tail. Are those entirely artistic then? There's no evidence for that?
Well, there's no direct fossil evidence, but there is evidence from something called phylogenetic bracketing, which I wanted to talk about when we talked about what these animals sounded like. And so if these things in pterosaurs are feathers, then, which for the record, I do think they are, although I have not studied the bones myself, but just based on the scientific papers and the evidence presented, if you got this is great podcasting, so I'm using my hands to show a diagram. You've got this end of the dinosaur family tree, and all the way over on this end, you have pterosaurs. That must have meant that their common ancestor had this fuzz.
I guess we could use like a mammal analogy that might sort of work for people. So if we see like monotremes. So we have like platypus and echidna, they're hairy. And we see placental mammals like us and hedgehogs and leopards and things, they're hairy. And we know that in between those two guys, you've got the marsupials. Then because the branches on either side of marsupials have hair, we can then assume that marsupials would have had hair. And in fact, that's the case that find that kangaroos and wombats are hairy. So that's kind of phylogenetic bracketing without using your hands.
Well, yeah, if you found an elephant fossil, and maybe you didn't have extant elephants to observe, they would certainly not preserve with hair.
Yeah.
As a fossil, you know, frozen ones from fairly recently notwithstanding. And so, you know, but with phylogenetic bracketing, an example that you put forth, Russ, you would be able to assume that they at least their ancestors had hair. This is actually a problem in mammals too. I know we think about like mammals, obviously they're fuzzy. Every mammal today was fuzzy in some way, but the fossil record of fur is not that great. So we don't know exactly when hair evolved. So I think these things should have been fuzzy, but talking about phylogenetic bracketing, the sounds that they made, can we talk about this a little bit?
Yes.
So for the sounds, famously, the T-Rex in the original film was like an alligator, a lion, and like a walrus and some other mammals. They actually gave the T-Rex, the male T-Rex, a different sound. They wanted it to look different. And one thing I did like about this movie is they tried to have male versions of many of the dinosaur taxa and sort of differentiate them a little bit. But the male Rex is a recording of pigs. And then they didn't film this in Costa Rica, even though it's supposed to take place in Costa Rica. They went and recorded sounds, but they didn't know what they were listening to. And I watched the featurette and the sound designer quoted as saying, weird Costa Rican mammals are what they recorded. And they combined those to make the male T-Rex. The baby T-Rex was a baby camel.
Yeah.
The Stegosaurus was a rhinoceros. The Pachycephalosaurus, which is the head-butting animal, was a vulture, sheep, goat, camel, and a rhinoceros. And the Parasaurolophus, the one with the long crest that they take down. Elvis, was a cow calling through a tube, which I would love to have a video of.
I read that too, and I really wondered how they got the cow to speak through a tube.
So the problem with all of those sounds is that there's too many mammals. So if you really wanted to get like, so for the fairly recent Apple TV Plus miniseries Prehistoric Planet, they very specifically only used crocodilians and bird sounds, which they pitched down to make the dinosaur sounds. The thing is, like, things like roaring is very specifically a mammalian thing. But by the other end of the spectrum, like complex bird songs like songbirds from the bird group, the Passeriformes, they have a specialized vocal structure called a syrinx. And if I was recording this podcast, guys, like 2 years ago, I probably would have said we've never found a syrinx in an extinct dinosaur. So they probably didn't have them. So that sort of restricts what kind of vocalization somewhere in between alligators or crocodiles and non-passeriform birds, which would be like lots of different kinds of sounds, but not like tweets and things like that. But we found two dinosaurs in the past couple of years, Panacosaurus and Palaeosaurus, which have syrinx-like structures.
Wow.
So it does seem like, again, dinosaurs, extinct ones, are not a monolith. It does seem like some of them probably had like complex, even like bird-like vocalizations.
Yeah, I think that's really cool. And also, you know, like even if we restricted ourselves to non-passeriforms, then birds make some crazy sounds. Like,
yeah,
listen to cassowaries or ostriches or other like branches of the bird family tree. I'm trying to think, my bird phylogeny is not great, but you've definitely got the palaeonates, like the ratites, the kiwis are also weird sounding if you've ever heard them. Cassowaries can do like really impressive deep booms. There's a whole, you know, they could sound like anything, and they could sound scary. Though I think also a T-Rex kind of twittering at you at 120 decibels or something would be pretty scary too.
Yeah. And an animal that big probably also used infrasound. So sound that's low enough that we wouldn't have been able to hear it, but you could feel it, which is extremely terrifying.
That would be, yeah.
But you know what you wouldn't have heard in this forest, which they filmed this in, they wanted to film this in New Zealand, which would have been very appropriate because New Zealand broke off from Gondwana about 80 million years ago. And so its flora is extremely bizarre and kind of a little bit of a time capsule to the Cretaceous. But apparently that was going to be too much money.
And it's a very dinosaur dominated fauna as well. I mean, until recently, birds, the only thing there that no mammals apart from flying or swimming ones.
Yeah, lots of ground-dwelling birds until we came and messed it up. But there's a kookaburra in a lot of these shots, which I think Josh, you're fond of pointing out that like kookaburras are often like in like jungle sounds in movies, even though they're specifically Australian fauna.
Yeah, it's a bingo trope for us.
Oh, okay, good. Let's knock that up on the bingo card. But they did film this in California in the redwood forests, which is actually not that bad. They wanted to pick a place that looked like a real place where dinosaurs might have lived. So they were trying to get away from like as many of like these broadleaf plants that you see in rainforest like Hawaii, where they filmed the first film. So, you know, there's a lot of things like I was just recently in the redwood forest in California. There are a lot of things like horse tails that are quite ancient. Even sequoia themselves, their relatives would have been around in the late Cretaceous. But the problem is, it's not supposed to be the Cretaceous of, you know, North America. They're supposed to be in Costa Rica. Yeah. So it clearly looks like, if you've ever been to like the coastal redwoods, it clearly looks like California. It does not look like Costa Rica.
Yeah. It looks like Return of the Jedi, which is also filmed there.
Yes.
I guess, you know, in the first film, one of the things that Dr. Sattler points out is that they do have extinct plants as well. So it's not, it wouldn't have made so exciting on a film if it was, you know, Jurassic Botanic Gardens. But they have obviously put some effort into resurrecting the plant life of the time period too. So maybe that's why the island looks like that, because they've been putting the plants there as well.
That's a that I, you know, I hadn't really thought about that. That's a great point. I think plants are so cool. I'm not a plant expert, but I my poor wife had to hear me like rant about this and take like 20 pictures of me with the horsetails when we were in amongst the redwoods. But there's nowhere on the planet today that you can go and see animals that were that are ancient. I mean, you can see examples like, you know, turtles are still around and things like this, but there's many places where you can go and see that the flora is sort of a relic of an ancient time. There are most of the major groups of plants, like if you know where to look, like they're still around. And there's even some weird things like monkey puzzle trees, which are a Mesozoic taxa, are used as ornamentals all over the world. So you can be in a park and just see like a dinosaur tree. I think that's neat.
Inverness, that's where I live, is weird in that it had a massive influx of Victorian money just when kind of ornamental gardens were a thing, and, you know, banks was bringing stuff back from all over the world, and, you know, having a fancy garden was the thing to do. So that there's actually tons of redwoods around where I live, lots of sequoia and lots of monkey puzzles as well.
Oh,
we've also got eucalyptus, you know, totally out of place, but they're all over. It's really weird. Like,
will cycads grow in Scotland?
I haven't seen any. We do get a lot of ferns, so ferns are native to here. So, and they grow wherever it's just a bit too dark and wet for other plants to grow. But yeah, just sort of just walking down the street, and you'll see like two or three redwoods and a eucalypt and a monkey puzzle just all in the same street. It's just bizarre.
That's amazing. Yeah. So look around you and under you and kind of open your eyes to these things. I tried to convince our groundskeepers at the museum to plant cycads, because they have a dinosaur sculpture garden out front. And to their credit, they really looked into it. They took me seriously, and they realized that they were never going to grow in Ohio outdoors. Mm. Because the ground freezes. Mm. So that's too bad.
I think one of the things that I was going to call back to, I think this is what I was going to say when I forgot, and it wasn't important. But yeah, I thought it was quite nice that they, like Joe was saying, that they've made the males and the females different. They give them different kind of vocal characteristics, different external characteristics too, and how that's different from the first film. But then I've got to remember, in the first film, they're supposed to all be female. That's sort of a minor plot point in this film too, that in the original film and book, they've been engineered to be lysine deficient, which is one of the essential amino acids. And they get around that by only eating lysine rich foods. But one of the other things is that they're all female in the original film to stop them from breeding. So because they have frog DNA and frogs can spontaneously change sex, that's the explanation for how they managed to breed outside their parameters. In the first film and in this film, they've kind of taken that on. So they're only eating lysine rich foods like soya, and they now have both males and females. They've kind of swapped sex, which is very common in the animal world, and that's how they're able to reproduce on this island without any human interference.
I think that was great that they did that, because animals are so resilient, and you know, there are, you know, all these examples of the animals that will seek out clay deposits to eat in order to neutralize the toxic alkaloids from the plants that they're eating. So I think that's extremely plausible that the dinosaurs on this island would, you know, life would find a way, and that they would be able to
say that.
Mitigate the lysine deficiency. We're all itching to say it. Sorry, I didn't mean to steal that from all that. I did study Xenopus in actually undergraduate when I thought that maybe I would want to do something with like genetics instead of paleontology. And we were inducing sex change in the Xenopus frogs and trying to figure out like what conditions elicited that, which was really interesting. I think it's one of the things that made me realize that actually I would prefer to work with long deceased animals instead of soon to be deceased.
Also, you know, it's not just a frog thing. Like it's very widespread in the animal kingdom. Like lots of fish do it. You know, reptiles as well. It's all over the place.
Animals are weird as hell. And if people learned like one thing from listening to me yap here, it's that you know, if even though we don't see the evidence for adaptations in the skeleton of an animal, I'm having balloons are coming up for some reason. I'm just so excited. Excited to talk about dinosaurs.
For the podcast listeners, balloons just rose on Joe's video for some reason, and I don't know why that happened. Does anybody know why that happened?
Nope.
I think it's a Mac thing. Thank you for describing it, because, yeah, I just alluded to it, and the audience may be confused. Even if you don't see direct skeletal evidence for a particular adaptation, doesn't mean an animal couldn't do that thing, because animals will do tons of weird shit just from observation. Yeah. So the range of behaviors of these extinct animals was certainly wider than we can imagine. So I think like when you see reconstructions or things like that, yes, some of that is speculative, but it's certainly like within the realm of plausibility. The example that everyone gives is goats are really good at climbing trees. Whereas, you know, it's like you wouldn't necessarily expect that. Elephants will swim miles out to sea just for shits and giggles and all kinds of stuff.
Some species of crocodile can gallop on land. That's pretty messed up.
Oh, wow.
That would be crazy to see.
I don't have that in my notes. Can I talk about that for really, really quick? I want to see a movie, one of these Jurassic movies, where they have some of the Mesozoic crocodiliforms, because while many fauna is in the Mesozoic were dinosaur dominated, some of them were actually like croc dominated, or at least they were present, and they weren't all the aquatic ambush predators that they are today. There were herbivorous forms, running forms, large terrestrial carnivorous forms, everything in between. Even into the Cenozoic, especially in the southern continents, but I digress. But we still see a relic of that today. So, crocodilians are archosaurs. They're in the same group as the dinosaurs, and their ancestors had erect limbs. They held their limbs directly under the body. Today, they have splayed posture like a lizard. But when they want to, like when they got to get across a golf course, here in the States, not here in Ohio, we've a dearth of alligators, but, you know, down south, they'll lift themselves up and walk, doing something called the high walk. Also, they have a four-chambered heart, like mammals and birds, but they have a shunt that goes between the atria. Are you familiar with this?
No, I hadn't heard this. No.
So when they're underwater and they're not breathing, they can actually shunt blood between the atria. So they're sort of essentially shutting off the pulmonary circuit. So blood's not going to the lungs because they're not breathing. and they sort of like revert back to a lizard-like cardiovascular system because they don't need to do that. But then when they're more active, they switch back over to this like four-chambered heart system like we have. And a four-chambered heart is a kind of a hallmark of warm-bloodedness.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
It's like a high-power, low-power switch they've got. Like,
yeah.
Wow.
Crocs are cool. For the people that are like, oh, man, they're putting feathers on the dinosaurs. They look so lame now. I want my Victorian dinosaurs. Buddy, have I got something for you. You can drive down to the zoo right now and find an alligator or a big saltwater crocodile. That is your Crystal Park Victorian dinosaur, and they're still alive today.
Yeah. I think they did a good job as well of like not using the Victorian sort of archetype that probably most of us oldies are used to, with like they very specifically don't have a tail dragging stegosaurus. Like it's very it looks very upright and modern with that kind of low head but high tail.
The stegosaurus it
stands
so
up pretty well.
Okay.
Now, I was going to ask about this because if I'm not mistaken, I read and I was trying to look for some screenshots that later in the Jurassic World movies, they have the tail down a little bit more. So what should that Stegosaurus tail posture be?
That makes me so mad, Josh. Thank you for bringing it up. So there's this idea. I do kind of understand this idea that like at the time that they made the original films, we didn't know as much as we do now about like they should all be feathered, and especially the Velociraptor and things like this. But the audiences expect them to look like they did in the original, and so we can't change them in subsequent films. I sort of get that from a filmmaking standpoint, although I think that they're not giving audience enough credit. But then there are times when they have changed the dinosaur models to be worse.
Yeah.
And an example is the Stegosaurus. So the Stegosaurus in this early scene in this movie looks beautiful. Its tail is high off the ground, and that's certainly what we think that they would have looked like. If you go to the Natural History Museum in London, Sophie is the Stegosaurus they have there. It's very famous. You can see the way that they have the tail posed. We have a cast of a Stegosaurus. If you're in the States and you want to see the best Stegosaurus, you have to go to the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. It even has the Gular armor preserved, which is the plate on like a chainmail sheet that they had on their neck. But anyway, yes, they would have had the tail up high, but then in one of the Jurassic World movies, it's like dragging its tail. And so they've changed the model to look worse. The Stegosaurus in this movie are way too big, but that's okay.
Yeah. I think they've also, and this is something I've just checked up myself, and was quite conspicuous in the film. So the raptors look the same, but they've rotated the wrists in this film compared to the first one. So in the first film, the raptors are, and I'm using my hands here, they're slappers, I think that's what it's called. Whereas in this film, they're clappers. So in the first film, they've got their hands like they're playing piano. In this film, they've got them like they're trying to catch a ball.
I am going to run upstairs as soon as we're done recording this and talk to my wife about this, because every museum we go to, she has to hear me say, psst, look, they're clappers, not slappers. They got the wrists wrong. yes, you're right. They could not turn their wrists to pronate them. So supination is, you know, hands, palms up. Pronation is palms down. I'm not an anatomist.
So we'll never have a dinosaur playing the piano.
Unfortunately, no. There's also like, I think a scene where the T-Rex, like notably like T-Rex couldn't have even touched their fingers together, but sometimes in a lot of these things, they have them like doing, manipulating things with their hands. But yeah, I also noticed, I think they lengthened the snout of the Velociraptor. That might've just been my perception, but it does seem like they lengthened the snout. I think you talked about this in your Jurassic Park episode, but the Velociraptors have a boxy skull in these movies because they're more based off of a related animal called Deinonychus or Deinonychus. Famously, Crichton met with John Ostrom, who's actually the graduate advisor for Bob Barker. And he was the person who discovered Deinonychus and kind of reignited the idea of birds as dinosaurs. Met with him several times to try to get things right, but ultimately went with the name Velociraptor, not because he just thought it sounded cool, although it does, but because he was also influenced by a book called Predatory Dinosaurs of the World from 1988 by Gregory S. Paul. You folks talk about, you're well familiar with the idea of lumpers and splitters, right? Because I think that's a constant debate in anthropology. Yep. Maybe you could, have you ever talked about that on this show?
I think so, yeah.
We must have, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Surely. Well, so lumpers like try to like combine a lot of things into one taxa, and splitters who try to create, you know, multiple taxa. And it's a little bit of a false dichotomy. But anyway, Greg Paul, ultimate lumper. He basically said that all these dromaeosaurs, these raptor, quote unquote, raptor-like dinosaurs, were all the same genus. And because Velociraptor was discovered in the 20s, it takes precedence. And so they're all Velociraptor. And so both Crichton and Spielberg said, sounds great to me. So they were trying to adhere to the science. They were just like, I don't know, I think maybe misled. I don't think Paul thinks that anymore, for the record, but I don't want to speak for him. He's still active in the field. But they would have had feathers for sure. Mm-hmm. And surely by the time we get to the Jurassic World films, damn it, they should be covered in feathers. Because in 2007...
Super disappointing.
2007, we found quill knobs on the ulnae of Velociraptor. So these are the big holes in the actual bone that the big flake feathers insert into. So not only would they have been fuzzy, they would have had like bird feathers on their arms.
That would have been cool.
Yeah. I think it would be cool.
And scary. If you've ever been sort of chased by a cassowary or an ostrich, then you know that feathers can be scary.
Yeah. Yeah. And they could have made blue have beautiful blue feathers, right?
Yeah, if they really wanted to differentiate the males and the females. This has been a problem with dinosaurs is we constantly tried and basically failed, other than a few select instances, to try to find evidence for sexual dimorphism in dinosaurs. We just don't see it a strong signal in the fossil record. And I think it's probably because it was coloration. And probably vocalization. If you look at modern passerine birds, do you have cardinals we don't even have cardinals in the Western United States. Cardinals are the state bird of Ohio. They're these beautiful red birds that the males have this bright red plumage, and the females are relatively drab, skeletally identical.
Certainly we have that with, For a kind of Europe-centric audience, like blackbirds or bullfinches, you know, skeletons are the same in males and females, but the external appearance is different completely.
Thank you for helping me find an example, Dr. Barnett. I've been to Scotland, but I was looking at the rocks, not the birds. Fair enough.
We do have great rocks here, that's for sure.
I should say, Highlands of Scotland and the Appalachian Mountains of southern Ohio are part of the same mountain range, as well as the Atlas in Scotland. We have a lot of the same
Long lost relatives.
I was extremely excited in a previous episode where you were talking about music videos, and you were talking about the fish Anichthys, which is a fish that is commonly found and sort of famous from Ohio rocks. I even have my Anichthys trading card here put up by our Department of Natural Resources.
Nice.
Fortunately, no dinosaur fossils in Ohio. So all the time at the museum, I'm like, yes, kids, T-Rex, very cool. But could I interest you in this trilobite?
That is a hard sell.
I could usually get him, because the thing is, you can't find a dinosaur bone, but you could go find a trilobite or a brachiopod in the deposits here in the state.
Great.
And and people come from all over to look at some of our fossils.
Ohio does have good Pleistocene mammals, though, subfossils. You've got that as well.
Yes.
Whereas I feel robbed in Scotland, where we don't have, where I am anyway, we don't have any dinosaur fossils, really, apart from Skye.
Skye.
We don't have any Cenozoic mammals, because they've all been crushed under miles of glacier ice.
Yep.
We do have, like, trilobites, ammonites, and belemnites, plenty of them, but it's very hard to get small kids interested in belemnites, because they're just like tiny little sticks of rock, essentially.
Yeah, you have some of the best Eurypterid sea scorpions from Scotland. Yeah. And that's easy to get people interested in.
Yeah. I think they're quite hard to find, though. And, you know, when you get the fossils, they look like an interesting schmear on a bit of toast. I mean, they're not very pretty until they're reconstructed.
Certainly. Well, some of the most famous dinosaur fossils and early fossils are from, you know, just a little bit to the south of you. But you were talking about Pleistocene fauna. The Megalonyx jeffersoni, nicknamed Jeff, the giant ground sloth mounted skeleton that's at the museum at the university here that I work really closely with. They have determined, I think, that is the oldest mounted paleontological specimen in the United States. And it's in this tiny, you know, university museum. And the mount is like, it's awful. It's like sitting on its tail but you know, they can't change it obviously because it's a historic specimen in of itself now.
Yeah. Mm. It's doubly historic.
Well, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about this movie or ask me about? I have, I'm a professional yapper, so I've been doing quite a lot of that.
I feel like I've learned so much already.
Totally.
Just listening.
I got a couple of pedantic notes to just throw out here, and then I'll ask you a couple of questions. There's the scene where they rescue that baby Tyrannosaurus, and they're sort of splinting its broken leg. And she says they've got an X-ray on it somehow. They had an X-ray machine on this van that they brought with them. But and she says, "There's the fracture." she says, "There's the fracture right above the epiphysis." But then the the video of the X-ray shows a fracture right in the center of the diaphysis.
Yeah.
The epiphysis is like the end of the bone, and the diaphysis is the middle shaft of the bone. So she basically says the fracture is at the end of the bone, but then the X-ray shows it right in the middle of the bone, which is very pedantic. But also she says that it's the metatarsal that's fractured, but then she splints the tibia. I don't know if a dinosaur has a tibia tarsus or
what. No, they don't have a tibia tarsus.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I didn't think about that. I mean, I think, you know, most people, when they look at a dinosaur skeleton, they, you know, one of the first things you notice is that they are like sort of walking on their toes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they did get that wrong. Also, if it was the epiphysis, this is meant to be a juvenile. It's meant to be like 2 weeks old, is this dinosaur. Mm. So it's a little bit too big. It's also like, we now know, I don't think we had any juvenile T-Rex at this time, but we do have some now. It looks a little bit too bulky. But also, I think that's because they had to hide the electronic components.
Yeah.
Because that one model that they're carrying was fully self-contained and battery-operated. Yeah. So we can give them some leeway. But, I mean, you know, like, animals grow just like living, fast-growing animals like mammals today. This thing would have been, like, made out of rubber, right? Like, its bones wouldn't have been fused. So... am I off base here?
I think that's right. I'm just going to refer back to Josh's pedantry with more pedantry. So, but surely, you know, she's still technically correct because it's above the diaphyses are above the epiphyses. So
yeah, sure. You know, every fracture will be above one epiphysis and below the other epiphysis.
That's so true. Yes. Yeah. Oh, wow. With Uno reverse on the pedantry. I did enjoy the depiction of parental care with the mother and father T-Rex and the baby. Because I think at this point we were just starting to sort of tease apart the idea of parental care. But again, phylogenetic bracketing. You have crocodilians, have complex parental care. Birds have complex parental care. Reasonable to assume that at least some extinct dinosaurs did. But by this point, we were starting to get, for instance, Sitipati Osmolske, which is a dinosaur from the Gobi in Mongolia that was actually preserved on the nest brooding.
Uh-huh.
Now, crucially, that fossil is called Big Mama, but we do not know whether it was male or female.
Yep.
And we do know that in some bird species, it's the male that does the brooding.
Like yes.
The emus and ostriches and stuff like that.
And penguins.
And penguins, yeah.
Penguins, yeah. Well, I thought what was also nice about the parental behavior is that it actually gives it a much more realistic reason to be attacking everyone. Like,
yes.
That's one of our bingo tropes, is that they're just attacking for no reason because they have to be big and scary. But the fact that there is a reason behind this, I think actually works for the movie, that these guys have stolen their baby. That's going to make them want to attack, but also not just give up as a normal predator would when it's not getting anywhere. It gives them a reason to kind of keep coming back again and again.
That's
and
a
then
really
get rid
great
of the
point.
Threat, even mm-hmm. once they, right? Once because they knocked it over even once they had the baby. So they just got
rid of
it.
Yeah, they came back. The velociraptors, they're eating. They're catching prey to eat because a human is like, you know, maybe prey size. The T-Rex are defending their babies. The other dinosaurs are kind of like just trying to escape from the InGen people and running away. The Compies.
Yeah.
Are like little hell beasts that eat that guy. And I that strains credulity to the point of breaking. But this movie generally does a pretty good job of not depicting these as like, you know, monsters.
Mm-hmm. They also address that directly because the Great White Hunter character says specifically, predators don't hunt when they're not hungry after the Tyrannosaurus has eaten the one guy out of the car. So they're like, he's not going to attack us now. It is funny to say that, and then in the next scene have those Compies swarm that guy in a really unrealistic way where he's like swatting them and choking them all, and like it's weird they would keep fighting after that. But
they can tell he's injured though, because he's just fallen down that hill. So
I guess so.
I would give them some credit there as well, that they've sensed an injured animal and they're just basically finishing the job.
It's also went away from the pack, right? I mean, that's exactly what carnivores do. Is the injured one was away from the pack. So if you're going to do it, that's
just
the
like
time.
The girl at the beginning as well, who's also away from the pack.
Oh, the T-Rex. So famously, Jack Horner was a proponent of the hypothesis that T-Rex was an obligate scavenger.
This is what I was going to ask you. This is going to be my next question. So where do we fall on this debate today?
It's a very silly debate, I have to be honest. So for two reasons. One is observations of living animals. So we have this perception that like lions are the ultimate hunters on the savannah and hyenas are, Ross is shaking his head, and hyenas are scavengers. Like, that's wrong, right?
Totally. Yeah, that boils my piss as well. You know, hyenas are, you know, amazing animals, and they've been done wrong for so long by so many people. And you know, they're as good, if not better, hunters than lions. And lions, more often than not, will steal prey from hyenas that they've taken successfully. It's just because they do it at night when us humans can't see it that we make bad assumptions about what's going on.
I think
they're smart,
King.
So they won't turn down a free meal as well. That sort of thing.
Do you know Behind the Bastards podcast just put out an episode making fun of Ben Shapiro's latest book, where his whole analogy for like American society is based on a misunderstanding of lions as predators. And it's like his analogy is like lions versus scavengers or something like that. And like, you want to be a lion and not a scavenger.
Why are all these right wing dickheads so bad at biology? You've got Shapiro. You've just talked about. You've got Peterson with his fucking lobsters. You've got all these dickheads talking about alpha, sigma, beta based on misunderstandings of wolf behavior. Yeah. I mean, read a fucking book. It's Jesus.
I think it's the quintessential. I think you're right. I think it's quintessentially pseudoscientific, which is they want to use the terminology and the trappings of science without having to do real science of doing research and confronting your biases as new evidence comes to light and things like that. They're essentially putting a scientific sounding coat of paint, and they know that their readers and listeners are not going to check up on it.
Yeah. Okay. They want the certainty of science without the fundamental doubt that is at the heart of all science.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, that's
doubting
a
yourself.
Way to put it.
Your methods, everything. I mean, it just really gets me.
Yeah. I'm fond of learning about pseudo-archaeology via your show and many others and my own research. And that's the other thing. That's like, it's not the scientists that are people that are like, we're sure of this and we're never going to change our mind. It's like actually the opposite.
Yeah, completely. Like, a quote that I read a while back, which has always stuck with me because I love it, is that you know, going into science for certainty is like joining a seminary to meet women. It's just you're not going to find it there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you asked me about the feather thing. And the thing is, like, we can't give like a really definitive answer because we're still learning things. And tomorrow we could discover a new fossil that might, you know, change our interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it do be like that.
It do be like that.
Well, I'm sure that we could talk about this movie for several more hours. Is there anything in our notes that we really want to get into this podcast before we close it out? Because I think we're going to have to cut our conversation short eventually. I'm sure that we could just keep going forever.
I did want to talk about the Thagomizer on the Stegosaurus.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good shout.
Have you waded into, because you've talked about this before, have you ever waded into the controversy as to whether paleontologists actually use the phrase Thagomizer?
I was reading a post on Reddit about this the other day where someone was like, actually, paleontologists don't actually use this term. And then I was like, I just like Googled Thagomizer. I Google scholared Thagomizer. And I'm like, no, I've found it used without commentary in scientific papers, like, just using the term Thagomizer without explaining what Thagomizer means. So it seems like somebody has to have used it seriously, but I don't know the extent to which it's just a common term in paleontology.
Yeah. So that Reddit post is infamous at this point. So I've mentioned him a couple of times and you should listen to his podcast, Terrible Lizards. Dr. David Hone is one of the people who's like, the thing is, dinosaur paleontology is a really small field. Like, there's not that many dinosaur paleontologists. I know people think that there's, like, so many of us. There really isn't. But anyway, he is he used to go onto Reddit and try to answer people's questions. And then be like, this is a PhD scientist who's, like, one of the world experts in dinosaur behavior. And that Reddit post is everyone, like, downvoting him and yelling at him.
I have that experience on Reddit regularly too. You got to go to a sub where you can get a flare that says what your credentials are.
We post my museum posts videos on social media, and especially, you know, YouTube is our most successful channel. And I will get people telling me I'm wrong all the time. And the thing is, like, I'm happy to be told I'm wrong. You know, if I did said something wrong.
You're not happy to get told you're wrong when you're right, though.
Yeah, no, I don't enjoy that. It can be an opportunity to try to teach people. But yeah, Reddit is not great for that. But anyway, to my point, there are a few paleontologists, a couple, who were fond of trying to enter that terminology into the literature. Most other paleontologists actively dislike it. Including Dr. Susie Maidment from the Natural History Museum in London is one of the stegosaur experts of the world. She will actively ask people to remove that phrase if they try to use it in scientific papers. And she is often asked to be a reviewer for these papers. So there are more papers that might use it than actually don't end up using it. So it's kind of like a couple people are really fond of using it and then other people really, really hate it. So it kind of depends on who you ask, I guess, is what I would say.
I think that's terrible because it's like PR. It's one of these great stories that connects people, makes science more accessible, makes scientists feel more like real people. And I think that attitude is terrible. Like we talk about it so much. It's such a great story that why would you try to shut that down? Right. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I think I totally agree with you. I mean, I think like we should at this point, we should just sort of embrace it because it's kind of fun. But the idea that there is this like universal repository of like terminology for science or paleontology specifically, like that's, you know, you all know that's not really a thing. We argue over terminology and, you know, scientists love to argue. That's like our favorite thing.
Yeah.
There are some museums that use Thagomizer on their displays. We don't, but not because I have deleted the text.
Which museum are you at, Joe?
I work for the Center of Science and Industry, COSI, which is in Columbus, Ohio. And we're a science center, so we're like hands-on style of museum. You're touching everything, push the buttons, and learn.
Cool.
We do have dinosaur exhibit. We're not a collections-based museum, so it's a little bit of a unique thing, so... We do have like real fossils and things like that. But I work a lot with the American Museum of Natural History in New York that our fossils are on loan from, as well as some of the other university museums and things like that. So it's a little bit of a, like, we don't have like a back room that's got like walls and walls of specimens that I can pull out and things like that. Wish we did, but yeah, so we're doing a lot of like public facing stuff with paleontology.
Yeah, really important.
So if you want to see some goofy videos of me ranting about dinosaurs and other prehistoric creatures, you go to our social media accounts. They'll either be just COSI, COSI, or I think COSI Science.
I think that's definitely our audience base.
Yeah. You also host a podcast, right?
Yes, I do. The two things that I wanted to give my shameless plug to is my podcast. My counterpart, I didn't ask if he could join us because him and his wife just had a baby, so they're very busy. But my co-host Dave and I have a podcast called An Hour of Our Time, where we pick a topic that we maybe don't know a lot about or have just gotten interested in, and we spend a lot of time studying it and then come back and try to distill our conversation into an hour. So we don't pose as experts. Occasionally, if we realize that we're like really out of our depth, we might actually find someone to come like help us out. But yeah, usually we're interested laymen trying to learn about a topic and share what we've learned and hopefully trying to inspire people to do the same thing. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about is my Dungeons and Dragons actual play show called The Shifting Realms. So if you go to YouTube and search for The Shifting Realms, you should find our episodes. We play Dungeons and Dragons in front of a camera. We voice our characters, and it's a sort of like improv theater meets radio play with the element of the dice adding a randomizing element, so we don't know where the story is going to go.
Cool.
So yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, it was great. We got so much good dinosaur information. I feel like we could have talked at least another hour and a half here. I think we should definitely have you on any other time we need to do some dinosaur paleontology or any other paleontology as well.
I will talk about the Jurassic World movies.
Yes.
If you need me to. We should do. We still got those on the list, don't we?
Thank you so much for letting me rant.
You know what I've been wanting to do lately is the cartoon series Dino Riders. I recently found the entire series on YouTube, and I also realized that there is a final episode where they go to the Ice Age, so we can get dinosaurs. Yes. And Ross is holding up what's his name, Rasp, the snake
remember,
guy.
But he's one of the toys I played with as a kid.
Yeah,
the Dino Riders. You have triggered a very deep core memory.
You can just picture the board meeting right now. It's like, kids like dinosaurs. Kids like spaceships.
Yeah,
yeah. Stick them together.
It's like chocolate and peanut butter, baby.
Exactly. And you know, they weren't wrong. I absolutely loved that series of toys, and I had a whole bunch of them.
Mm-hmm. That shit was like catnip for little Joe. Oh my god.
Absolutely.
Definitely was better than the mammoths, the Jim Babe mammoths milk thing that we watched.
The Mastodon's milk commercial on our 100th episode.
Oh god. I gotta listen to that one.
That's a good episode.
I tried to block that, I think.
Do you have questions, comments, or movie requests? We want to hear from you. Find us on Blue Sky and Facebook at SOTSA Podcast. Send us an email to screensofthestoneage@gmail.com or visit our website at screensofthestoneage.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.